Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Hey, buddy, welcome to the This Life podcast. Bob, what's happening, buddy?
We're back.
We are back indeed, and we are joined by Curtis Matthews and Mark Lundholm. Am I pronouncing the name right?
You are correct, sir.
Mark Lundholm. Describe the organization. Describe what you guys are doing. This is the comedy, Attic Comedy Tour.
I've seen it. I haven't seen this tour, but I've seen these guys.
Yes. I did. So we did Celebrity Rehab in 2008. Go ahead, Mark. Tell them about the tour.
Attic
Comedy
Tour.
Tell them how funny it is.
Yes. Let's see. It's funnier than they're used to talking about this disease from I'll tell you that. It's a couple of guys who've maintained a certain amount of liberty from addiction, doing recovery process, all kinds of shame and blame and dysfunctional family feud stuff. We put it out in a way that's gentle, funny, and
relatable.
Easier.
But one of the things people miss about addiction, and that I kind of love about it, the working with addicts, fucking funny. Addicts are funny. The shit they pull and the stuff. It's
you also have a dark sense of humor.
No,
you
can
get
become tragic. I understand it can get out of control and has a dark side. But when people try to pull stuff on me, I just think I just want to laugh out loud.
Well,
it's so funny
for you. There's an EMT quality there. You got to be a little bit of a gallows humor guy.
Yeah, I guess
that's what he is.
Wade through whatever that is, because humor has a way of removing shame, lessening the threat, and making it memorable. If we make it funny, something's easier to remember. What's your favorite TV commercial right now?
Guarantee it's funny.
Oh, yeah.
Mine isn't funny. The opiate poop medicine.
But you could make...
Do you know about this?
Yeah.
Have you heard about it?
Yeah.
Bob's really into poop.
Yeah, for you,
just
Bob.
Just getting started, guys.
Yeah.
But to me, if an addict comes in and starts working me for that medication, now I'm laughing. Now it's like, oh, come on.
Yeah, they've
the
never
people
seen...
that the businesses that advocate, I'm angry. And the government agencies that
it's
think
crazy.
It's
how many
ideas.
Millions of Americans must be on opiates if they have a medicine to poop when you're on it?
Oh, listen.
He's still on the poop.
You didn't understand something.
I hope you have a good poop today, Bob.
Guys, in the
already
heyday,
did, my friend.
Thank
heyday,
you for sharing. Go
in
ahead,
the heyday
Dr.
of
Drew.
Chronic pain management, this was the big grail, which we got to come up with something that lets us give our patients appropriate amounts of pain medicine without needing to have their colon removed. I'm not kidding. It really was terrible.
That's sad.
Hasn't
you ever
addiction morphed?
Pills, everything?
I did everything in certain stages, and then I found a favorite flavor.
What was it?
Yeah, it was meth.
Oh, yeah.
Meth?
Yeah, I would snort.
I wouldn't pick you as a meth addict.
Well, I was. Well, you're a pro. You tell me what I was doing.
I just say painkillers, opiates, benzos.
You know what? I did. I snorted heroin to come down so I could go boost stuff out of the liquor store. Because they watched this guy. You know, the guy who shuffles along, they don't keep an eye on him. So it was balanced. It was a three-ring circus under one tiny little tent in my head, you know.
And where was it? In San Francisco? That's where you hit bottom?
I was an Oakland, California native. Yeah. And I hit bottom there. Put a gun on my mouth, pulled the trigger, and it didn't go off.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was 1988, and I was 120 pounds, shake and bake, look and cook, tweak and peek, thump and bump guy off the street. Just rattling around in my own skin.
See, that's the juxtaposition for me. There's nothing funny about that. Nothing.
The funny part about it was
he can't even kill himself.
Well, see, that was the thing. My first...
You guys think that's funny? Well, I don't think that's funny.
Listen, it took. You don't have to touch me while you're talking about it. Anyway,
in fact, that was don't touch me, Bob.
Yeah, I got it.
I'm halfway kidding. I'm halfway. Take the hat off. We'll talk. But,
and then he'll remove your colon.
I pulled the trigger and the gun jammed. And my first thought was, I suck at everything.
Yeah, I've heard other addicts describe that.
So it was really a bottom. It was despair. Like, I can't even do this. My disease basically is, and there are a lot
I think
of
DJ AM said that about his suicide attempt. Said, I can't even do that. I can't even kill myself. I'm a fat cocaine addict. And I can't even kill myself.
I'm not joking. At the stadium in motel by Dodger Stadium, I loaded so much heroin, it looked like mud in there, trying to kill myself. I woke up like hours and hours later, and the first thing out of my mouth, dehydrated mouth, was, you got to be fucking kidding me.
Yeah,
I can't even do this.
Yeah, but you tried to share a needle with an AIDS patient. That was close.
Well, that was necessity.
Listen, that's funny.
For me, that is funny. I know that's what you meant, too.
Right. It's the dark side. See, for me, just doing dope was suicide on layaway.
Of course.
It's all suicidal. Somebody says I wasn't suicidal. Well, every time you use, you know you were going out. You just got a bag or a bottle of finish, so you're not done. It's coming. we just don't jump into it with both feet right away because we're, you know.
Talk to us more
about
the tour.
We don't commit to much.
Where can we see
let me share my bottom.
Please, please.
Where was your bottom?
At least I have a bottom, Bob.
This is back to the colon stuff, evidently.
No, well, it was my second drunk driving accident, and I missed a car full of girls, and I almost died, and it was in San Dimas. That's really the bottom. Anything that happens in San Dimas is the bottom.
Yeah, that is true. Fair.
And I was done.
Bill and Ted's Big Adventure.
That was 84. You remember that. Yeah. So I quit drinking and using in 84, and Mark was right behind me. We've been friends for 26 years.
Wow.
Tell them more about the tour, Mark.
The tour is available at addictscomedy.com. You could see there's more dates on there that I do. I don't want to take
up the
time.
Is there a Twitter feed or anything to follow?
Yes, at addictscomedy. We've been in the Northeast. We've been all over the country, the Midwest. We're going to be in Southern Cal at the end of April, Brea Improv, and then Indio Performing Arts Center, over to Phoenix to do Rick Bronson's House of Comedy, and then we'll be at the Comedy Cafe in Tucson.
Do you guys tag team or follow each other? Are you up there together?
It's a co-headliner show. I do 45 minutes to an hour up front. Mark does 45 minutes to whenever he wants at the end. Yeah,
I'm the second guy, but we do the clubs and the theaters. We're not hard to find at all. You can Google Recovery Comedy. We'll be all over that place. We got a good web guy. We got David here who does all the stuff.
Do you do any sort of outreach into recovering treatment centers or anything?
Let me just real quickly, Mark started comedy in prison and rehab, and Mark goes in and talks to men. He's at facilities doing one day workshops or 3 day workshops. Humor in treatment is one of the greatest comedy videos that people that are brand new get, and so a lot of our fans have seen Mark and they know Mark and they say, thank you for helping me in the first 30 days. I saw your video, you gave me a reason. And we still do it. If we have extra time, we'll go over to and most of the time they ask for Mark, and it's great because they know him. So we'll go over to a facility, and Mark will talk to the people. We'll give people some hugs, a little bit of the show, and then we do the show at night. So, yeah, it still has to be about service. We got to give it away to keep it.
There's always an ancillary visit on the road, a prison, a jail, a rehab, a detox, a shelter, some halfway house.
And you guys were a part of Celeb Rehab. Was that the thing we did at the Ice House?
Yes.
Is that, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I was not at most of that, so I'm sorry I didn't really get to see
you. Well, you came in for a second. I shook your hand, like little people, and you slapped me.
How dare you?
It was a drive-by, but it was what you were doing at the time.
Actually, I was a little, to be fair.
He hated taking the clients out of the hospital.
I hated it. They were really sick, it made me very nervous.
Well, they had a tough time.
Yeah.
It wasn't really fair to them.
And I didn't want to really be a part of what the producers were. I had to look at it as recreation. They're okay. It's not my thing. They don't need a doctor there. But they needed some pictures of me at the thing, so I came and took the pictures.
And that really was it. Yeah. It wasn't a thing. Yeah. But here's the thing. It was my junkie move to come up with that rather than do whitewater rafting, they really wanted the clients to do on day eight.
I learned how not to allow...
Whitewater rafting.
It was
on the board of what they wanted us to go do with the attic.
Right.
And so
I said, what about comedy? Because I knew of you guys. I knew of it. There was another team called Not a Glum Lot or something about Glum Lot.
Yeah.
They used to do...
Lousy.
Well, they relapsed.
I'm kidding. I don't know them.
Was this the one at the coffee
glum
house
now?
The Ice House?
People have been doing comedy, of sobriety since the 80s.
No, but listen. But it turned out very good. I felt good about what you guys did. They actually talked about it, and that some other things happened as a result of it. So it turned out very, very good.
This is what happened in there, honestly, because I didn't know, but I know when people are brand new in recovery, sometimes they're real sensitive.
Yeah.
They haven't learned yet that being an alcoholic or drug addict might be, as a recovering person, is one of the greatest things that can ever happen to you. They don't know that yet.
No.
So I remember being in there, and there was a lot of egos or something, and not Mark. Mark was willing to be of service, and so was I. And they're like, who wants to MC? And nobody raised their hand. And I said, okay, I'll do it. That's a crap job.
Yeah.
I didn't even think the cameras were on. I was just talking to people. And I remember I said to Steven Adler, how'd you even get thrown out of Guns N' Roses? And he goes, that's what I want to know. And now then somebody said, that's a Dennis Miller line. I'm like, oh my God, that wasn't even that clever. God bless Dennis Miller. So I was just talking, and then I remember talking to Sean Stewart, right? And Sean, all I said to Sean was, you have nice hair like your father, and he said, thanks. And then I just thought, I'll give an older, sober guy wisdom. And I said, I hope you don't treat women the same way your dad did. And I wasn't trying to be mean. I was just, you know, being playful. And like, he started crying. I don't know what happened. He cried, and I just thought, wow, I just got on TV, which is sad to think. But that's what I thought. I go, I'm going to make this show. I went out and apologized to him. They
I'd
didn't show that.
That there were some ripples as a
right. They didn't show that part of me apologizing to Sean and telling him I was sorry and putting him back together. Because God forbid, you know, if actually people recover on that show. So I don't know what I know what you guys were doing. You cared about their well-being. I don't know what was happening in the background. But we had a good time. And I thought Rodney King was fantastic.
He's
I
love he was the greatest
It was
guy.
Too bad what happened to him. But I loved he was a
you know
sweet,
what happened
sweet man. No, I just met him there. And we
no
talked.
One seems to remember or understand what happened to poor Rodney.
He had a heart attack.
Yeah, he and it was some in the bottom of a pool
and
or
he
something.
Fell in a pool.
It's just sad. And I really liked him. And I remember Tawny Kitaen being really nice and that Shifty from O-Town. I didn't know what was up with that guy, but he was nice. But we had a great time. Good. And we were just trying to be of service. And I didn't know the cameras were rolling, though, when I was doing that riffing thing. And I
but
got
historically, comedy within the 12-step community has been there the whole time. The Big Book says we're not a glum lot. We're supposed to be able to be comfortable in our own skin and wear our sobriety like a loose-fitting garment. These are things that have been lost lately, and I'm glad you guys are talking about it and doing it,
well,
and bringing it into the young people and the
quick,
new people.
Before we get to Mark, Mark was the first.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And when it, and like
there was somebody copying you, Mark, in Los Angeles in 1985.
Well, no,
God
there,
bless him.
Well, yeah, Mark has been. Mark was. Well, there's Yuckaholics. That happens every year in Los Angeles, and those guys.
Maybe
are,
that's it.
And we know all those guys, which is great.
Yeah.
But I'm saying the first person where people started asking for money in NA conventions and saying, look, this is actually a skill and this is a thing that you want. And it's not just I'm in recovery and I'm funny, but it's also I'm going to tell you my story. I'm going to be brutally honest on stage. And Mark was the first.
Awesome.
In a lot of ways, there is a recovery comedy market and industry because of Mark. Now I'll let Mark talk.
I was going to go clinical here. Clinical clinical comical, which is, listen, I do 600 hours of group every year all over the planet with people who trust me with their inmates, patients, students, soldiers, families. I'm not a clinician. I never graduated from anything except county. But I'll tell you what, I go in there and we talk about clinical issues like CBT. No, first thought wrong. First thought wrong, that's your disease. Heroin's a good, attractive flavor. Or I wasn't a gambling addict. You don't have a gambling problem? Every time you used, were you gambling with your whole family? And you're, now they got a gambling problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, we break it down like that really fast. I remember it. And it's funny all day. I mean, I leave tomorrow. I go to the ranch in Nashville and Burning Tree in Texas and the refuge in Florida. I got clients all over the planet who trust me because I'm funny. Clinical, that's secondarily, but I always sneak it in.
But the humor is the connection piece.
Yeah, they put down their defenses. When I tell them, hey, I grew up in a dysfunctional family. I was the oldest of five kids. In our house, ADD stood for all different dads. That's, just, that's my house, right? That's they laugh and they, you know, 12-step meeting. Sure, yeah.
That's a good one.
Well, thanks. I thought so, Bob.
That's what we do, Bob, professionally.
That,
come on down.
That breaks it down so they go, oh, he's not going to tell me what everybody else tells me the same way. I trust this guy because he's a goof.
I brought Dr. Lisa Stroman back to be a part of this conversation too. She's a psychologist and attorney. You know her from a previous podcast. We end up on the last podcast with you talking about connectedness. Do you agree with me? Humor is a way to connect.
Comedy.
Absolutely. That's what our family did the entire time. Is we actually did use humor just to get through those difficult times. And in fact, my brother actually just passed away. Longtime addict, and he was so wasted in the end. I was helping him turn over, and I was like, shit, you look like Flat Stanley. And he said, Lisa, he's like, fuck you. He's like, who's Flat Stanley? So, he had no idea. But those are kind of some of the things that we use.
Even if that humor muscle that you were given from birth is used as a shield, eventually shield protects. Now, initially, we get the treatment. You got the shake and bake clan that the people write out of their third-degree burn victims trying to sleep on sandpaper sheets in treatment. That's the way they – everything's crispy. So you got to be delicate when you're talking about funny because I'm not making fun of the addict. I'm not making fun of their family. I'm making fun of the mentality, the insanity, that story you try to tell 50 times. I'll go into a jail and I'll say, listen, I love being in a place where everybody's innocent and all the stories are true. You know, and right there we're in. My ex-wife, the plaintiff, she's got 20 years clean. She's an NA goddess, and I make fun of we got you know, divorce will teach you things like fractions. You know what I mean? Yeah. So we get to play with this disease in a way that nobody gets hurt. It's not kid gloves, but it's really, really, really very dark.
If you get divorced four times, how much do you have?
You know what?
Next to nothing.
I don't even want to think about that.
You have a love and sex addiction problem, probably.
Well, I wanted to talk about that. Do you guys get into that at all, love and sex stuff?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I do. each part of the each part of the show is different. I mean, my experience and Mark's are different, but yeah, I had a love addiction. I went from person to person to person. I could never hold myself up, and it wasn't a sex thing. I mean, because for me it was love. So I had to be in love to sex meant love to me. So right. So yeah, I'm in recovery from that.
Have you seen the new TV show Love, the Judd Apatow series Love on Netflix or something?
I have not. You know, it's interesting. Judd and I were open mic buddies back in the day, and every now and then I'll cross paths with Judd, and I'm just happy to see it. But I haven't seen it.
Well, it really is a good,
it's Drew's favorite show.
Well, not my favorite show. It's just a nice exploration of all that stuff, and it's not clean. It's messy, you know, and that's the way that stuff tends to go.
Well, you know what's great about Judd is, even though I wouldn't call him a recovering addict of any type, he's always been very reflective into looking at what's going on.
He's a co, isn't he?
Codependent. Yeah, very codependent. Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, constantly.
That's the Judd I know.
Yeah, yeah, constantly reading books and on a quest, which is fantastic. Yeah. So yeah, I love Judd a lot. But I'll talk about that. I mean, I talk about my experience, which is mostly alcohol, cocaine, weed, and vagina. So you know, that was my thing.
But Lisa's thing is technology and porn addiction.
Sure. So yeah, it can be a bad thing.
Do you get into that?
Absolutely.
Do we get into it on the road or? Recovery from
nothing's off limits, you know. Addicted to the social media, addicted to the not so social, anti social media, I call it, which was porn. That's anti social media because it changes the way I think about women. I used to be a porn addict. I went to the SLAA, Sex and Love Addicts. Yeah. I went once. I didn't go inside to meet. I helped some chick relapse in a parking lot.
Lady.
She was in a white van. It was cool. But we touch on all those things because it's the mentality of I don't have a problem with that. I never had hit a bottom with that. I'm going to do this. The love addiction, the sex without love addiction, the relationship without sex addiction. You know, that codependency. Well, honest to God, most people that...
Are you talking about American marriges for a second?
Listen,
there?
Let me tell you something. The families that you
I
deal
made
with...
him laugh. That makes me so happy.
I'm just worried about your colon still. Mark,
the families that you deal with, they make Shameless look like a documentary, that show.
Her own family makes Shameless look like a documentary.
How else would she get into that business?
Her dad's been married 8 times.
Eight times.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. So he's a survivor, right? I mean, that's just what that's how we
do
look
that
at
fraction.
It. Yeah, that's how we look at.
Maybe
it.
It's
do
him.
That fraction.
Yeah, we had this true story. But it all heals with humor. My ex-wife, we're very good friends now, and we were married for 7 years. We were in therapy for 9. That's not a made up joke. So we wanted to learn how to talk to each other. Well, I'll tell you what happened was when we had a non-com for 3 weeks when we were getting divorced, so that nobody gets bitter. And we just, you know, hey, listen, shortcut for you out there. If you're getting through a divorce, whatever, there are no ex-kids in a divorce, ever. There are no step-kids when you hook up. There are no ex-kids when you split up. They're your kids, period. We're married to that kid for the rest of our life. We're raising a 9-year-old. He's irritating. So, because he's 9, right? But we had an annulment. At Catholic Church, you get an annulment, right? That's the Catholic version of the lemon law. You just turn it in, you get another one. It's okay. So
that was a mistake, like a gimme or something?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You go back to the lot on Sunday, pick out a new and used. It doesn't matter.
Then you can remarry in the Catholic Church.
Right.
You have the annulment.
As long as you pick another Catholic
again?
He's
being optimistic.
Again?
He's going to do this
So here's
again.
The joke part, right? This is the bitterness. She said to me, she calls me and she goes, hey, listen, what are you going to do with your wedding ring? It was expensive. I know I bought it. And I said, listen, first thought wrong. We're not supposed to be talking to each other. It's been 2 days since they told us a non-com. And I said, listen, let me eat. Let me eat. Because you know how we get when we're not eating. And I said, I'll call you back after I ate. She goes, oh, I know how you get when you don't eat. So I call her back after an hour. I'm calm. I said, listen, what were you asking me? What are you going to do with your ring?
Put the ring.
And I said, well, I hadn't thought about it. She goes, why don't we take that ring and sell it? Because I know it's expensive. And put it in Grayson's trust fund. I was, A, first thought wrong. I hate her for thinking of that, and I didn't do it. B, I don't like being told what to do. C, come down off the perch. Just, okay, fine. She goes, I said, when do you want to do this? She goes, right away. And my first thoughts were, she said, right away. I said, why don't I melt it down into a bullet? I'll get to you as quickly as I can, right? We laughed so hard on the phone because we were both angry, but humor has a way of making that just like fade into the background.
Breaks it down, definitely.
The issue. So we use that constantly on the road, in the clinical settings, the jails, the rehabs, the prisons, the place they can't get out to go to meetings. The clinical comical is really off the radar. I don't even put it on the schedule.
You use it in your ability to connect to others, though. And I think that's what Drew's trying to get to, is that a lot of times addicts or people that are in that area of sex addiction, they don't know how to interpersonally connect. And so humor is a very easy way to get people to kind of align and get what you're saying and connect.
There's
with
so
you.
Much shame in that lane. The addiction highway, I call it. There are lanes on the addiction highway. There's meth, there's opiates, there's weed people. They're always in the slow lane. And then there's the people that weave into every, that's the drunk, you know. They're in all the lanes there are. Well, that porn, that sex addiction. I'll work with a certain facility in Tennessee where they are trauma-based child survivors of, and we talk about freedom starts with forgiveness. You forgive the perp, there is no victim. You got two choices, that's all. So with the trauma-based sexual addiction stuff, we'll talk about how humor will remove the shame because they'll admit to shooting heroin into their ball sack. That's fine. Porn addiction, they won't talk about it because all of a sudden that's less manly, more scary. And the women who are supposed to be, porn's a man's disease, right? Not even close. It's like eating disorder is a female disease. Not even close. So this disease doesn't care about indoor, outdoor plumbing, who turns it on, IQ, zip code. It don't care. Right? It's more open-minded than some of us who have it, actually.
Equal numbers is what they're saying, is that porn addiction with women and men are at equal numbers at this point.
It's gambling and everything else. And there's a way to do it without shaming them because they already brought in that huge bag of shit.
Are they? Wait, I know that statistic is blowing Drew's mind. Let's explore that.
No, I just wonder if they're watching different things.
I think so. I think that absolutely, they are watching different things. But I think that the girls are actually watching porn in a lot of ways. They start out because they're trying to catch up and see what the guys are learning, quite frankly. So I see teenagers and
learning
like all the way
internet.
Down to like 11, but I'm and all the way up through college and adults. So
yeah.
The last 10 years, I think, is when I started getting into the technology stuff because I started seeing how it's impacting in my practice and impacting people.
So you can learn now on the internet how to shoot up heroin and how to have appropriate sex.
I don't, you
know,
that's
what young people are doing.
They think that they're learning appropriate.
Yeah, I found, you know, every one of those ends with the guy having sex, you know, right? He could go, you got funny teeth and giant feet, and it's like, oh, that's hot, right? That's not real life. So, you know, I would think the ladies are trying to watch porn that have feelings in it. Is that?
It's more the romanticizing of they're trying to figure it out. But Hot Girls Wanted is a really great documentary that shows how they get into it and why they're doing
yikes.
It.
Yikes.
Well, I talked to a woman that's a porn producer director, and she said, look, I've been doing this a long time. She goes, I finally realized men want to see people having sex. Women want to know why those two people like each other so much that they want to have sex.
There you go.
That's the difference.
I deal with a lot of all female populations, like clinically, and they'll talk about porn addiction, how they got started. They watched it with him. They would share it, you know. So I said, okay, I keep this real simple. I'm a knucklehead, you know. I don't know if there's any kind of bright light moment for them, but I'll tell them, listen, when you watch porn with your man, you've been replaced, not revered. There's only two choices. You're revered, it's just you and him. You're replaced, and you're still in the room. That's what happens. And what are you going to go back to now when the film's not on? Now when the video's not on? What are you going to go back? Because it's a progressive disease, right? You know, on Thursday, you watched a porn about an orgy. On Friday, when you're going to make love or be intimate on Sunday, what are you going to go backward to just two of you now? The addict brain doesn't work like that.
So what about the 3D porn and the virtual reality that's coming up? And like, would you have come, because how did you get out then? How did you do it?
I stopped doing it cold turkey. 8 years clean. 8 years clean and in recovery, I stopped porn altogether. It was messing with how I heard her, listened to her, saw her. My brain is saturated with more.
A lot of, pretty much, some data suggests 85% of addicts have some sort of sex and love stuff, sure. If not fully diagnosable condition. But many times, and Bob and I, we used to always say this, that a program well done will address all that.
Yeah, all of it.
Because it will eventually, somebody will bring it up. You'll have to be honest about it. You have to come to terms with it and deal with it. Now, if you need help, you're really still out of control with it, then by all means, SLA. Which mm-hmm. program do you like?
SLA.
Yeah.
There's SA.
The SLAA is a good one. And SA, if you really have
established my own boundary as opposed to, you know, don't masturbate, which I couldn't do. I honestly just like to share that with America right now.
No, I mean, yeah, listen, but
you have to have, are you saying sharing that comedically or clinically?
You have to guess, Bob.
I think both, Bob. Your colon wasn't comedic or clinical.
But to be fair, I mean, that's what
I don't even know if it's clean, Bob.
That's what circle plans are, is you determine what's in your plan with your sponsor or your clinician.
Exactly.
I got to take a break.
Yep.
You got to take a break. We are with Mark Lundholm and Curtis Matthews. They are the Addict Comedy Tour. Check it out at addictscomedytour.com, right? And the Twitter handle is?
At Addicts Comedy is the Twitter.
All right,
handle.
Dr. Lisa Stroman is here with us as well. She's an attorney, psychologist, Technology Wellness Center is her place. Bob, anything you want to quickly promote?
No, let's go to the break.
Right, go to break. Be right back.
We're back.
We are back. This Life Podcast. Reminder, our friends at Rocky Mountain Treatment Center, they are very proud. Of course, they're up there in Montana. They're very proud of their equine therapy program. I just like the fact that their staff is just basic, no BS.
And I like the fact that it's no BS in the middle of nowhere.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The other thing I like is you're not coming back easily. So I want you to stay there for a while and really get with the program. They've got great clinicians there. It's Rocky Mountain Treatment Center. The equine program, they are run by Professional Association of Therapeutic Horsemanship International Certified Counselors. And again, people that have trouble connecting, sometimes that horse can be a conduit for connection to our right brain, which is really what's so dysregulated in addiction. So there's a lot of nonverbal stuff that goes on between us and horses.
I've noticed.
But do not mistake the hardcore recovery is what you must be ready to participate in, because that's where it all happens.
The real deal is what I call it. And the fact is, most of the places that do the real deal left anymore in remote locations. In Desert Hot Springs, there's a place called The Ranch. It's about 10 miles outside of Desert Hot Springs. If you want to leave, they say, go ahead, fucking go. And you're going to walk in 120 degrees down a dirt road down into Desert Hot Springs.
I'll remind you, our patients, remember the shifty who you brought up went to Eric Clapton's program? And
swam to another island.
It's surrounded by shark-infested water. He swam to an island to
get crossroads.
Swifty's a one in a million, but you guys
there's nowhere
know,
to go from there.
He you must know funny escape island. Stories from rehab.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of work with the Meadows, and that's in Wickenburg, and nobody wants to go to Wickenburg. And I want to take equine therapy. That's one of the last things. My dad was a horseman. You know, he owned
there you
horses.
Go. Maybe he
and,
was doing
and I
it
fear
and
them.
Know.
Because as a child, they seem huge and just scary.
They
and
scare horses, me too a bit.
Horses get weird around me. So
yeah. Because you get weird. It's because you get weird around the horse.
Exactly. So I choose at this point of my recovery. It's like I've gone to the Meadows for love stuff. I went love addiction, love avoidance, the Pia Melody.
Wow.
That was helpful. And so
let me put a little highlight on that. Love addiction, love avoidance cycles are very helpful for people, even if you don't have a
did
just,
you go when
just codependence.
Was there? When Carnes was
that's
there?
That's the sex guy. Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. He's
was he
around.
There?
No, he wasn't there
no,
when
Pia
I was there.
Pia Melody is still there.
But Carnes, Bradshaw, and Pia are all kind of in the Meadows, but they have
they're
good,
from the Meadows, yeah.
Right. They
well,
have
Carnes ran it, right?
No, Carnes now in like Missouri. He's in Missouri.
Well, yeah, but he right, wrote the Missouri. Book. He drops in every now. He's a guest speaker, so God
oh,
knows
really?
Where he was.
Wow.
Yeah, they got a whole thing happening.
Well, no, but Meadows, again, the thing about Meadows, though, it's a trauma-based program. And a lot of places, let's talk about trauma a little bit. A lot of places avoid getting into that. I talked to an outpatient program here in Pasadena recently that likes to do psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy with drug addicts. And I said, well, not in the first 6 months. For one thing, there's no way they could. The brain's not working right. Secondly, I'm always fearful that stuff's going to
open people up and
evoke,
spin them out.
Evoke stuff. You, first 6-12 months, just fucking stay sober.
Yeah.
Get the program.
Yeah.
Put your ass in a seat.
Absolutely.
Shut up.
Absolutely.
Kind of, yeah. And the people don't understand those basics.
No, it's
take direction.
First year is physical. You know, the second year is emotional. Third year is spiritual. Every year after that is optional.
Okay, so what should people... I agree, right? Especially first 90 days. It's just your brain...
Just hang on.
...taking the swelling coming down.
Drink water.
So,
eat
so
food.
So here's the
get
thing.
Sleep.
Why is it that in the first 90 days is when you have all the treatment? It's crazy. You're not going to remember 8/10 of it. You know what I mean?
A lot of it's
because
money.
You have post-acute withdrawal. You're not going to remember it. It's really... hard to even understand what it is in your trauma therapy that you're trying to figure out. You know you were sexually abused, but how does it connect? Somebody with 3 months doesn't know how to do that.
No way.
But all the treatment is loaded up front. And I think, you know, what the new modern model needs to be...
Well, I was going
to
say, yeah.
Towards the end of
well,
the year.
Not only that, more outpatient,
contain,
more outpatient-oriented,
yeah.
more basics.
What do you guys think of that?
I think it's a lifetime. I think you're constantly going back, and what did I miss? As I wasn't kidding when I said, if I have vacation, if I block a 10 days, I might go to a 7 to 10 day workshop rehab retreat or something for something.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly learning. It's like in the anonymous programs when you're reworking steps.
Long-term. Treatment works better. There's a place in Texas called Burning Tree. It's a year commitment, year residential.
Yeah, Origins
a year
has
afterwards.
One down
it's,
there, too.
It's Extended Care Alumni Association. You get a treatment center that doesn't have an alumni association? I'll tell you what, they don't know what they're doing.
Well, they a lot of them don't
alumni
know what
they're
doing.
Alumni is the best marketing you're ever going to have. It's also the biggest way for them to plug in, even informally.
Well,
the alumni.
This is Jason Waller's model, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So but, I mean, freaky young males particularly need that
content. You have to plug in. Yeah. And in 90 days, it's just a walk and start. It's a baby in a crib. And after that, you get to deal with issues 6 months, 9 months, a year down the road. Long-term treatment works better. 90 days, you can't handle something.
But do you understand
trauma.
That average treatment, even with the insurance model going right now, those treatment centers are getting paid between $20,000 and $30,000 a month for all this great therapist. And the therapists and the people that work there and the programs are great. The patients just aren't at that stage to have that kind of care. Sometimes. That's really got to be thought about in the 21st century.
And it creates burnout in staff because they get the rebounds and it really is problematic that they don't have
and
that.
And since this is just a layman's estimate, but 99% of all addicts are codependent anyway. Mm-hmm. Their core issue is I need to be needed. When I feel unnecessary, I grab something I need to remind me how needy I am. So at 90-whatever percent, they're codependent. So when somebody freaks out in treatment, now it spreads like cancer. Everybody's in their treatment. Everybody's in that guy's treatment. That's why the trauma stuff is so incendiary, you know, early on, or the big ticket stuff. Mm-hmm. So they get into everybody's treatment. There's enmeshment there, and nobody's on their own path. Nobody's doing their own work.
So do you think that with the alumni program, do you think that that's a healthy way to create a community that's safe for them, that allows them to feel comfortable, because that's what they're used to?
Yeah, the alumni is like the big brothers, big sisters. It's a mentorship thing. Then it's also like a club. When you're outside the facility, listen, a lot of us feel abandoned when we get out of treatment. I know I did. They cut the lifeline, and I'm supposed to just go to meetings on my own now? I didn't have that kind of sand. I didn't have that kind of commitment. I'm a runner. I'm a rabbit. I'll point a finger, blame and shame, and run the other way. That makes me feel safe, right? But to alumni association, they will connect you whether you like it or not. They will reach out to you. There's a place, Sierra Tucson, Tim McLeod. He's got a program for the alumni. He's the best guy in the nation.
Bob used to run the alumni program for us. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it was important, and it's marketing. Oh, I mean,
but listen, it's we keep an eye on them. What's going on? How you doing? And then they help us enroll the other ones. Yeah. But the I want to examine something you said there about you're talking about group process where people expose their traumas. Is that what you're talking about, where it becomes incendiary and infectious?
Yeah.
I have found it shouldn't be done
in the first 30
days.
Well,
I agree. However, I'll tell you one thing I do is I'll often get people to tell their story of trauma just to help everyone else understand they're not alone with it.
Right.
But not to get deeply into it.
Yeah,
and process
that's a great point.
Yeah.
Because you bring it up for the commonality. You go, oh, me too? Yeah, I thought our house was the only one that happened.
100%. Right? Because they all think they're the only one. And I find at that stage of treatment, it's hard to get them to really care about other people's stories. They just want to know, fantastic, I can talk about
this. Well, maybe there's a different celebrity level of care.
No.
But no, I'm being facetious.
For 20 years, and believe me, it's the same old.
But yeah, it's hard to get them to get outside their own stuff, but yeah. I find it funny that they'll take the inventory of the staff.
Are you kidding me?
You know, where'd you go to school? You ever go to jail? You ever shoot up? I'll always tell them, did you ever ask your dealer for their resume? Did you ever ask him for an ID or bill of sale or proof of purchase? Any questions for your dealer? You took it and you ran.
Do you remember the nose-to-nose thing with Barry?
Do you know what it feels like to have somebody stuffed or tickled?
Remember that? Yes, I do. It was a very famous person going nose-to-nose.
Do you know what it's like to what? Have something up your butt?
More colon stuff. Come on.
to be sexually abused by an adult when you're a little boy.
Good Lord.
And pushing his face into the doctor, the physician.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
as if that does anything.
Well, and I'll tell the guys, inmates at jail, I'll always tell them, hey, listen, you got a lady who comes in, maybe she's never done time. Maybe she's never been to jail. Normal people don't.
That's a good guess.
No, they don't go to jail, right? No, they don't go to jail. You ask somebody in a rehab how much time did they do, they'll go, all together? Yeah. That's their answer, right? They don't say, what are you talking about? So if somebody comes in a square, a lay person, somebody, a slug, they'll call it. Slugs never run to jail. You know what they know how to do? They know how to not go to jail. That's a pretty good thing to learn from that person. You know? Maybe they don't teach you about fashions or sartorial splendor or anything like that or some kind of IQ, but they don't go to jail. That's a good thing to learn when you get out of jail, not to go back.
Right.
So there's a humor quotient that has a delivery system that makes it easier and safer.
Encourage
and
support.
I was giving Lisa some grief last show she did with us about smiling through stuff. But maybe there's this. Maybe this is the humor you guys used.
And not that $100 fake Rolex smile. Not the one that the ventriloquist. Like, I'm dying, I can't tell you. Yeah. I loved it. You know, but the one where they laugh hard from the gut because we cross color boundaries, we cross sexual boundaries. Not to call somebody out on their stuff, but I'll get going and rolling, and they'll figure out. You know what? He doesn't care. He's not here to teach, reach, or preach. There's some funny stuff here. The insanity of the disease. The insanity that says I can do this, but not that. I can do a little of that. If I cheat on her, I'll appreciate her more when I come home. You know, that kind of, you see people do just what you did. Yeah. Yeah, like that. And we're not laughing, but we're talking. That's a big deal. They trust me. They'll tell me stuff in 2 hours they won't tell their parents or their priest. Honest to God. Because I'm a goof. But I know how to, I'm manipulative. I'm a thief by nature. So I'll steal their trust. And then I'll give it back to them.
Do you think in the 12-step community that storytelling is being able to tell what it was like, what happened, what it's like now is becoming a lost art?
Oh, go ahead.
I wonder if that's something to do with the technology takeover, because storytelling generally, autobiographical and story sharing. Because
brevity. Yeah. Shakespeare said brevity is the soul of wit. Most people go on and on and on. There's stories. I'll tell them, if you can't talk in 2 minutes in a meeting, pass. Mm. If you can't do it in two, pass. Just say, I can't do it in...
Yeah, what is that about our culture that's happening? Because when I came into AA in the early 80s, these guys could weave a story that was just mesmerizing. They really could.
I'm sorry, Bob. It sounds like you want your money back.
I want our generation to step up.
I got to do junkie translation.
Yeah. No.
He wants people to listen to his story.
No. What I was thinking
is that's how he heard it.
Good evening.
That's how you heard it.
That was really completely off.
I don't even want to go tell my story.
I want 30-year-old people that are 5 years sober to go tell their fucking story and make people laugh, and they can't.
I hear you.
That's what's crazy.
I hear you.
They haven't talked to people in a long time, but you give them the impetus to speak in a meeting. Be honest, be brief, be seated. The three B's, I call it. Be honest, be brief, be seated. Give me it in 2 minutes. Somebody will ask you later to talk for four, talk for 15. You know how we do.
Yeah.
But you got it. It's like a pitch meeting in Hollywood. Just give me the spine of the story. You don't need 8 minutes in a 60-minute meeting. If you're a 12-step person, you're a thief if you do 8 minutes. There's a 60-minute meeting, there's 40 people in there. You do the math. You just stole. Why don't you leave us to lick the bag and go home with nothing, right?
Answer my question. Do you think it's becoming a lost art?
Sounds like my PO now. Wait, Mark.
I don't know if it's becoming a lost art, because I still meet people that have great stories. I don't know. It depends. I mean, every one of those anonymous places you go has its own, you know, it feels different.
But you guys travel a lot more than anybody.
Well, I was going to say, Chris was with the BBC, right?
Yeah, I did a TV show for the BBC.
Was it in England?
Yeah, no, it was actually in Northern Ireland, which was fun.
Oh.
It was fun. And my job was to train Northern Irish kids to be funny, and it was fun. We went over to Scotland, and we have love for Scotland because of Harriet, our lovely PR person.
And there's no alcoholism in Scotland.
There's no what? Yeah. Well,
you went to meetings. Did you go to meetings in Scotland?
I can't confirm or deny that I go to anonymous programs, but probably. Okay. Yeah,
but,
probably.
But was the storytelling better than in Los Angeles?
No. I think some of it was, you have some people that are selfish and it's all about them and it's not a great story. You have somebody, you know, the people in the back that are quiet that say, let me tell you something, and they say it in 2 minutes, that's the person you want to go talk to because they have a lot more, right? So
the guy out in the valley knows.
You said lost art. That's true. There's more people.
How do we get it to be back in the mainstream of the 12-step community? Because I tell my, not that I go or I'm in it in any way.
Yeah, right.
But people that say are under, you know, you're guiding through. I say what it was like.
Mm-hmm. What happened, what it's like now.
What happened, couple minutes. What it's like now, couple minutes.
Right.
And they don't really get the getting sober part, the what happened. I'll coach them. Like, dude, this whole thing since I met you till just like now is what happened.
Right.
You've been trying to get sober for 5 years. You know what I mean? To try to coach people.
If you're trying to get the younger kids coming in, I would just do a small test to see if you put it on the ability for them to write it up, because I get the most interesting emails at 2 a.m. from my 20-year-olds giving me a full detailed exposure of what occurred on campus or something like that, that when they come into my office and they're sitting in front of me, they have a really hard time talking about. So it would be really interesting if you
and then how do they translate that to giving it as a speech?
They don't. Well, I'm saying I have to teach them how to interpersonally reconnect and communicate in real time, because they do not do that anymore. And I think that maybe that's what you're reflecting on.
Yeah. Yes. That sounds exhausting.
Addict rule number one. Addict rule number one is keep it a secret. Don't talk about it. Isolate. First stage of relapse. Isolate. You know. You and if you got to keep it a secret, don't do it. That's what we tell them in treatment. If you got to keep it a secret, don't do it. That'll change your whole life, even if you're not an addict. No secrets from nobody. Out in the real world, our disease is sick. In here, it's not a secret, and secret is safe. There's no sickness in treatment. So that, but we're not used to talking about it, at least in a rational, honest way. Yeah, and I had stories upon stories upon stories. The fourth layer still wasn't true. I got to hold my mud. I got to cover my, you know. No, if they find out, the game's up. You know, so writing it down. There's
the shame piece. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why we have them write too. It takes a while to. It takes some. If you're going to lie, it's hard to lie from your head to your hand. There's something that happens in that shoulder, down the elbow, the forearm. There's something that says we can't lie.
Super interesting of handwriting analysis. If you do a statement, I took classes at BAU, at Behavioral Analysis Unit, that they actually show that where somebody's lying, it's the first third, and then 75% of the statement is what the falsity is. So you can kind of see where the story breaks apart. So it's super, for me, like, I like getting the writings because I can actually break down what it is they're trying to say.
If I have them write long enough, I get to the real deal. You know.
Can they connect the dots? Your guys in prison, can they connect the dots that the reason they're in prison is very simple, black and white. It's called alcoholism, and they need to stay sober upon parole.
Because
I haven't had that it seems so black and white to someone like you or I, but it's still not black and white to the guys that I've tried to deal with.
How do you want
to
explain it to them? I mean, in a funny way, I can tell them that criminal doesn't mean bad. Criminal means you got caught, right? There are a lot of smart people back there. High IQ, though, equals low bottom with this disease. High IQ equals low bottom. That's what I've seen.
Low bottom.
High IQ equals very low bottom. The smarter you are, the handicapper you be. A medium IQ person, they don't have all the tools and answers for it. They're not going to outthink a disease you can't outthink. High IQ equals low bottom. I tell them that all the time. Criminals are smart people.
Yeah.
They just got caught. No, it's gambling. You can't win all the time. So if you stay clean and there's no secrets, maybe you don't have to go back.
But I'm talking about the recidivism rate so high. Most people in prison, when I've ever gone just to L.A. County Jail, they're all going to stay sober, just like they all found Jesus and they're all innocent. That transition into that first 48 hours outside of jail, that... How do you help people?
That's why we connect them with a 12-step program. We connect them with some kind of Friends Outside. There's a program called Friends
Pick
Outside.
Pick them up?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what needs to happen.
We'll baby step them into a meeting.
Who's we?
We. Me and the people that do the H&I stuff. The anonymous people that do the take the meetings in.
Mm. Saska was insisting that people go to a treatment center post just as they're getting out on parole, but the money dried up. That
drug
was
courts
working
are huge
good.
Now for the same reason.
You know, there is so much scientific data coming in showing the effectiveness of 12-step, and yet there's still all this craziness out there saying that it's not evidence-based. And there was an article in LA Times recently, today, assailing physician diversion. Because it's not scientific and it's a failure.
It's a 12-step based thing for doctors.
I get to work for the AMA, the monitoring program they have.
Yeah.
They got to see me once a year, just the comedy version. Because they give them, what, 3 or 4 hours of instruction in med school?
Oh, please.
Three or four hours of instruction in med school, if that. About
We got them for a week, maybe up to 3 weeks at a time. So we, over the course of, what, 10 years we did that?
Yeah. The Keck thing?
We probably brought around 50 of them.
Yeah.
And and 10 of those weren't interested.
I think they're becoming more aware because of what's happened the last 5 to 10 years with the opiate explosion. I think they are. I think doctors
are more aware, but they don't understand.
They don't.
No.
They don't. And I had 4 or 5 dealers out there. Why wouldn't I have 4 or 5 pharmacists?
Sure.
Or physicians. You asked a question about the 12-step based stuff.
Yeah.
12-step, it's for sick people. It's the community center swimming pool. You know there's piss in there. You go in. You go in. You don't piss in the pool. You stay away from the people who are pissing. That's how you survive 12 step. It's by definition, it's toxic. It's not for well people. Yeah. No, there's no healthy people in there. Healthy people don't need 12 steps, so there's nobody in there that's healthy. Yeah. We don't get it righter or tighter than other people. It's a process, so you don't piss in the pool. And if nobody's talking behind your back, you're not going to enough meetings, Bob.
You used to, Bob, be a little more critical of stuff. Huh? You used to be a little more concerned about the
health and well-being of it.
The high school-y kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know? No, it goes on. Now, I said the same thing the other night. People gossip and shit talk. It's just part of it, the 12-step world, whatever. You know, obviously that's a component of it. You know, my thing is that I don't think Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob were these, you know, they were human beings, and I kind of, you know, point out that they were human beings, and it's strange the reaction I get.
No, that's actually...
They were really human beings.
I think that's part of being an alcoholic or a drug addict, where it's like, nobody's a bigger deal than you, Bob. You know what I mean? How could Dr. Bob or Bill Wilson be a bigger deal than you? You know what I mean? So I hear stuff all the time, and just the way I am in life, unless I saw it for my... There's so many rumors about, you know, like sex...
Well, there was that movie about Bill Wilson. Well,
and James Woods, right? There you
no,
go.
No, no, no. There was a documentary came out. Did you see it?
Okay, well, yeah, from the 50s, but... there's the sex stuff in the big books on page 69, right? Hilarious. Or written by a sex addict, you know? So it's just what works for me, right? What works for me. This higher power stuff. I'm not going to argue with you about God, but I know when I get out of my own way and I throw something upstairs, my life gets better and I don't drink and use. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the efficacy of 12 steps for people that I've seen that really work it is fantastic. I'm a prime example, 31 years, and Mark's 28 or 27. And, you know, so I'm not going to argue with people. It works for me. It might not work for others.
And if you're a 12-stepper out there who's got no God, the atheist, I sponsor an atheist, okay? You take out the word God. Put in the truth. You'll do every step just fine. Take the word God out, higher power, whatever. Insert the truth. Made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the truth as we understood it. You got no argument with me. It's not semantics now. It's tomato, tomato. Just go to work, man. Just go to work. It ain't you. 12 steps, step one, I don't know. Step two, I'd like to. Step three, I'll ask. Step four, I'll look. Step five, I'll tell. Step six, I'll count. Step seven, I'll wait. Step eight, I'll make a list. Step nine, I'll make an effort. Step 10, I'll look in. Step 11, I'll look up. Step 12, I'll reach out. They're not hard.
And mic drop.
It's the only... No, but that's the only test you're ever going to take where you already know the answers before the test even starts. Mm-hmm. It's the easiest thing ever. We're just really too smart to get better. I'm so bright I can't learn, man. That's addict stuff. Were you guys listening? Sometimes I don't answer the question I was asked. It's tough to get me to talk.
ADD, I think, is also part of the disease. But
what did you say about my dad?
What? Yeah. Here's a story about Mark's ADD, which I love.
Before we go, goodbye, I want to shine a light on that because we have patients all the time coming. I figured out it's just this Adderall. It's what I've needed all along. Like, yeah, is it before the meth or after the meth? Right? Yeah. And the generic name of Adderall is dextroamphetamine.
Yeah.
Amphetamine, everybody.
Yeah.
So if you're an addict, you do not take Adderall. Right. Period. End of story. Do not take Ritalin. Do not take psychostimulants. You have ADD. There are other treatments.
Right.
I consider ADD a marker for addiction in a family with a history of addiction.
I agree. Well, I told my doctor, I said, I have some ADD. And he said, on you, man, it's a feature. I'm like, okay. Well, and so I didn't take any.
You just dodged a bullet.
But my favorite was Mark said to me, because he always has these great gigs that he wants to take me to. He said, do you want to go do comedy inside Folsom Prison? And I'm like, no, but I want to hang out with you. As we're driving to Folsom, I'm nervous because, you know, he works these murderers all the time. I'm like, this is a bad idea. So we're about half a mile.
Scared just hearing the story.
We're half a mile away. And I said to Mark, I said, what's the first thing I need to know? And he goes, hey, look, pigeons, right? And that's what interested him, were these pheasants and pigeons.
Let me tell you about this guy. We're on the way to Folsom, 3-hour drive. He has one cigarette. He says, do you mind if I pull over and smoke? He goes, yeah, he has one cigarette. Afterwards, same 3-hour drive, he had nine.
Yeah, I had a carton.
That's what he did.
It was terrible. It was.
That's how prison affected
me. We were walking out in the yard, and people are like, hey, what's up? There was no, we had like an old AA lady walk us in. There was no protection. We're in the Folsom.
Need it.
And he's like, hey, what's up? And I'm like, my God, that guy's peeing right in front of us.
We didn't need it. It was okay. It was all right. Nine cigarettes on the way home.
By the way, we do comedy if you want to see our show. everybody.
Yeah, I've never smoked a cigarette in my life, and I was a heroin addict. You know, I got boundaries for my health.
I'll
go down on a hooker, but I'm not smoking. You know, that's bad for you. There's no Surgeon General's warning on a hooker.
HPV.
See, I looked.
HPV.
Get the vaccine, man. Yeah. I finally talked to somebody at the CDC who said any age can get the vaccine now.
Yeah.
So
it's a great idea.
Just an FYI, because they'll only approve it up to age 28, but it will work at any age.
That's good to know, because I deal with a lot of that population.
You got to find a doctor who's willing to sort of find or get a release. Maybe Lisa can write up the release for us, because she's an attorney. But it would save a lot of cancer, I'm telling you.
That's great.
It's only because the studies were done, the money was spent to approve it up to age 28. That's when it has most efficacy. But, you know, a lot of people later in life are getting back out there again.
Right on.
And they were not treated. They still have active HPV, and that's serious business.
That's good to know.
That's good advice.
We have a male client who sounds like Mickey Mouse on helium because he had HPV attack his vocal cords, and had to keep getting more and more taken off. And I was like, just stop going to Vegas. Like, stop picking up the women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Step one.
I didn't know you took care of high-pitched Eric. Amazing.
Hey, listen, I heard your interview on Stern.
The one from 2010?
Yeah.
It just aired last
week. Just aired a few days ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Thanks. Yeah, it was really good.
It was.
Really good.
You go in there.
I was supposed to eat breakfast. I stayed in a parking lot so I could hear it. No, I'm not kidding.
I appreciate it. I don't really remember, because you go in there and he puts you in a little bit of a fugue state. He's so penetrating.
Yep.
And you got to be just completely honest and just respond.
He jumps around.
He's going to make you sweat. He'll eventually talk about anal sex or something. You're going, what? Yeah. How do we get to? He would talk about my patients too, and I'm like, dude, come on.
Right.
But he knows what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing. I have real admiration for that whole group.
Yeah, it was good though. It was
say
really
what you will.
Good.
They talk about the truth. That I think is what he's going for.
And he's really good at his job.
Yeah.
You know, but you did a great job.
Thank
I listened
you. I
to that just
that.
A few days ago.
I had another one after that when Mindy died. And he let me talk about it for real. Now, almost no one else really let me talk about how horrible that was for us.
Was not a happy time.
No. Mm-mm. No, we lose them.
Yeah, I know, and no one gets that.
No.
We're supposed to be able to fix them all, and just if you have an MD after your name, you're really supposed to be able to fix them all.
And
I'm helpless. You guys know how helpless I am.
Yep.
I can show them the way just the way you can. A patient of mine said the other day, she goes, I just think you've kind of, you sort of turn them towards God. That's about all you do. I'm like, okay, whatever.
Wow.
At least I can be sort of helpful at least.
Wow. No, and then we lose them. And I've lost more people clean and sober than I have loaded or on the street. But and you get to know them and you have an investment of time in them. But you know, the best part about that for me, this is a little bit of cushion here, is they're cured. They're all done. They don't sweat. They don't pay taxes. I feel horrible because I don't have them around or in my vicinity. But they're cured. That I got to see them at their very best, and then they're done. And I can honor their memory by building myself up from knowing them, or I could wallow in whatever that self was that says they're not there. But it's hard. It's hard. And you probably see way more than I do. But they're cured. They're all done, and they are at rest.
It is difficult, though, like as a practicing clinician, and my husband's a medical physician, and it's the same thing. We've lost patients in our practice, and it is one of the most devastating things that again, behind the scenes, I have several doctors that I see, and they just need to come in and talk about it, what they can't do, and that's the part that I think is really challenging.
I found myself studying philosophy for like the last 10 years, because you have to get philosophical at a certain point. What drives me a little crazy right now is the expectation that we can cure everything or make everything perfect or make life great. I can't. I can't do that. None of us can. And to have sort of even a family or an individual or a press or social media expecting otherwise, not me.
Yeah, and
I wish I could be all those things.
The self-care, how's that for you? Yeah. The self-care in the healthcare business? It's awful for a lot of people.
It's horrible. They don't take the time. They're overworked. They're punishing themselves.
Burnout, apathy, red tape, insurance laws. That's the enemy. The disease is like simple compared to all the trappings of that. And you watch them blow up weight-wise, and they get burnout, and they're snappy. And if you don't think that an addict can read you, you know, treatment is like a zoo with all the cages open, all different animals. There's no doors, and so it's really important to like rest and take care of myself and all that. Otherwise, they can tell right when I walk in. Oh, he's grumpy, or he's too tired. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Listen, our borderline patients would know when I drove onto the campus.
Yep. Yep.
Isn't that weird? Remember that, Bob? And that, yeah. And by the way, my parking was 500 yards away from the building. They couldn't see it.
There's some kind of energy.
Isn't that crazy? Yes.
Yeah, borderline. I was married to a borderline personality. Oh, yeah. And good news, bad news. Bad news is borderline personality. Good news is you get to have sex with a lot of different people. But so we
HPV.
Pretty wild sex.
Yeah,
they got antenna.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? That's what Sasha used to do. She'd go like this. When I walk in, she'd do that my favorite Martian sign over her head. Yeah. She goes, they know you're here.
They do.
What'd I do?
It's crazy. Yeah. It's insane. I used to tease her a little bit. I never cheated on her, ever. I was married for a long time, and I wanted to be faithful. I grew into that from a cheater and an abuser and all that stuff. But it was important in the process, the 12-step stuff. So, and I said, but I would say this on stage. If I was going to cheat, she'd know before I pulled out. Honest to God. I could be two countries away.
But it sounds like, I mean this in peace and love, which is that borderlines attract sociopaths, and you're describing yourself. And you're describing yourself as sociopathic sort of stuff.
Right on time.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how did you, it's so great when people recover from that.
Empathy is a muscle.
Manage that. Yeah.
None for nobody else. Yeah.
It's really hard for people to get that.
It still flares up.
Yeah.
It still flares up. And I didn't think about so-and-so for two whole days. And I'm in a relationship with her. It's crazy. So I have little tools. I have a little step. I have a little 10th step.
The only time I see sociopaths get vastly better is in 12 step.
It's a lot of work, man.
It's also why he doesn't get scared in the prison. He knows he can outmanipulate those guys.
Now that I know I'm touring with a sociopath.
No, he's not. He's a treated.
That empathy muscle. Like a humor muscle. Everybody has a humor muscle. Everybody has But mine, you got to work it out 3 or 4 times a day.
Yeah.
And there's a practiced art to saying, okay, where's she coming from? Where's she coming from? She's talking. She's a professional. I could be funny, but this is shared space. Yeah. So I had to ramp down there about 2 minutes ago. You heard?
No, I did.
Down ramp.
You got it.
You feeling safe, Curtis, now?
Huh?
Are you feeling safe traveling with him?
I'm very afraid. My inner child weeps. The inner person.
We're all over the place. The little person.
Well, yeah. As comedians, too, this is the one thing Mark and I'll tell you, as opposed to other comics, is, you know, we're not okay. But that's our whole show. We're not okay. People that want to. No normal person wakes up and thinks, I have proper amount of self-worth and love, and I feel good about my life. You know what? I want to go to a crappy bar and just talk into a microphone and tell people what I think. There's something wrong there. So the journey for Mark and I, being that I've been doing comedy since the 80s, as has Mark, is that we're going to lead with that. We're going to tell you we're not okay, but it's okay to not be okay, and this is what's funny about it. So it is quite a journey, and I love this guy. And, I'm probably a sociopath in some ways, too, so I don't feel safe with myself, and I have HPV, and Bob's colon is weird. By the way, we do a comedy show, y'all. Come on down.
Go on down and check it out.
See, Bob's antisocial. He's not a sociopath.
Oh, okay.
A little different. It's a little
punk
different.
Rock. I call it punk rock.
Oh, my God. All right, we got to wrap this up. Guys, it's been really a pleasure. Congratulations on all the great work.
Thank you so much.
And your success in comedy and your continued success. And I mean, we need armies
doing God's work.
Yeah, we need armies of folks like this. So.
It's an honor. You as well. It's really a huge, big deal what you've done.
Well, hopefully these people will learn from this. And Lisa, thank you as always.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You know, everybody says I like comedy because I can't stand crying. And comedy is the inversion of crying.
It's also, I've thought a lot about this lately. It's humor is some truth. It is the truth that makes us uncomfortable. It's seeing something real or something that we wouldn't otherwise have an insight to or be able to even manage or address without the communal, somebody bringing it to our attention as a group.
Yeah.
And then we laugh. I think like probably 8 times out of 10, laughter is about discomfort.
You ever look at a target?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a bullseye, right?
Yeah.
Humor is the outer rings. As soon as you start hitting those, you get centered. You can start with the most outer ring there is. I can make anything funny. Anything. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah, I believe you.
At least the outer circle. And the there might be 23,000 more circles to get to the target, but we'll get there if you stay put.
And we appreciate you all being here, Bob.
Thanks again.
Anything? This Life Podcast. We'll see you next time, right, Bob?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, see you then.
And now, Dr. Drew Pinsky. Say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight. All the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Oh, the land of the free and the home.